Welcome back to Behind the Scams. I'm Nick Henley. Over my 25 years in federal law enforcement conducting financial crimes investigations, I've sat across the table from some of the most calculated predators in the country. These aren't the hackers you see in movies wearing hoodies and hanging out in internet cafes. These are very educated people who wear tailored suits or designer dresses, carrying high-end designer briefcases, and they will look you in the eye with a smile while they're continuously robbing people of every cent they've ever earned and spewing nothing but lies. Usually they are accompanied by high-powered attorneys saying, "You don't have to answer that," or "Take the fifth on any question you pose."
And I'm Sue Henley, and I have heard most of Nick's war stories, and trust me, even though he is long retired, the fraudsters and scammers he chased back in the day have now been replaced with scammers with AI and high technology in their arsenals. Usually, I'm focused on the bricks and mortar side of our podcast, Behind the Scams. You know, going through court records, finding documentation, and all that kind of fun stuff. I guess you can call me Nick's online sleuth. But the case you actually found and brought home today, Nick, it's chilling. This is the story of Jamal Nathan Dawood, a man who didn't just steal money, he systematically dismantled a man's life.
Exactly. This is a forensic blueprint for what I call assistance-based fraud. In 2019, our victim, Thomas Battaglia, was at his most vulnerable. He was in his late 70s, grieving the loss of his brother, and suddenly responsible for an estate valued at over $2 million. We're talking retirement savings, multiple real estate holdings, and complex probate issues.
That's a lot for anyone to handle, let alone while you're mourning. I imagine he was just looking for someone he could trust to take the weight off his shoulders.
And that's exactly what Jamal Dawood promised to be, a life raft. He introduced himself as a financial expert who could handle the complex administrative and tax burdens. According to the Department of Justice, Dawood established what we call a fiduciary-like relationship. In my experience, that's a predator putting on a shepherd's coat to get into the pen.
A fiduciary. That implies a legal and moral obligation to act in Thomas's best interest. How did he manage to cross the line from advisor to thief without Thomas noticing?
He exploited the technological gap. I saw this all the time in the field. Thomas was old school. He preferred in-person banking. He wanted to walk into the branch, talk to a teller, and hold a physical, printed paper statement in his hand. To him, if he could touch the paper, the money was safe.
So let me guess. While Thomas was looking at a physical paper statement once a month, Dawood was operating in a digital world Thomas didn't even know existed?
Precisely. Dawood helped Thomas open a bank trust account under the guise of organizing the funds. But while they were sitting there together, Dawood was secretly setting up the digital keys. He took total control of the online interface. While Thomas was waiting for his monthly visit to the branch, Dawood was already moving the money via unauthorized wire transfers.
So the balance Thomas saw at the teller window was already a lie by the time the paper was printed.
It was a digital sleight of hand. And as we're going to see in the next section, Dawood wasn't just after the cash. He had his eyes on the real estate. Now, once the digital back door was open, Dawood didn't just stop at the cash. He moved on to the heavy lifting, the real estate. In my career, I've seen hundreds of thousands stolen in an afternoon. But stealing physical property, someone's home, that takes a special kind of audacity.
This is the part that really gets to me. Thomas owned his home, and he had just inherited his brother's properties. How do you convince a man who has owned property his whole life to just hand over the keys?
You don't ask for the keys. you ask for cooperation. Dawood sat Thomas down and gave him a masterclass in fear-based planning. He told Thomas that owning these properties in his own name was a massive liability. He used words like lawsuit-proof and tax-sheltered. It's a classic sham ownership strategy.
Many people use corporate entities for their rentals for legitimate protection, so I can see why that sounded professional. But what was the catch?
The catch was the fine print. Dawood convinced Thomas to transfer the titles of his primary residence and the inherited properties into various corporate entities. He looked Thomas in the eye and promised him that he would maintain a majority ownership and total control through these new companies.
But let me guess, the companies were just Dawood and his associates in a trench coat.
Exactly! They were shell companies. The moment Thomas signed those transfer documents, he was legally severed from his own life's work. He wasn't the owner anymore. The company was. And because Dawood and his business associates controlled the companies, they effectively stole the real estate right out from under him.
That is sickening. It's one thing to have money disappear from a screen, but to lose the roof over your head because you thought you were being smart with your legacy? How did he keep Thomas from finding out?
This is where the emotional abuse comes in, Sue. Nowadays, people call it gaslighting the victim. Whenever Thomas would get a weird feeling or ask to see the corporate records, Dawood would turn on him. He would call him an old fool. He'd tell him his memory was failing or that he was too old to understand how modern finance works.
That is a calculated tactic to isolate him. If you make someone doubt their own mind, they stop asking questions.
Precisely. It keeps the scam going longer. While Thomas was being belittled in his own home, the FBI was starting to look at the forensic trail. Because even with shell companies, money leaves a footprint. So Thomas is being gaslit at home. But meanwhile, at the federal building, the light bulbs are finally starting to flicker on. In financial crimes, we have a saying, people lie, but paper doesn't. The FBI's financial crimes unit began a process we call layering analysis.
Layering? That sounds like something you'd do with a cake or maybe cold weather gear. How does it apply to $1 million?
It's a laundering technique. Predators like Dawood don't just move money from point A to point B. They move it from point A to shell company B to business associate C and eventually to purchase D. They're trying to create so much noise that an investigator gets tired and gives up.
Well, they clearly didn't know who they were dealing with. Forensic accountants don't exactly get tired when there's a $1.8 million hole in a trust account, do they?
Not at all. The FBI started tracing the wire transfers. They found that Dawood wasn't just taking management fees. He was wiring massive sums to his own personal accounts and, this is the part that really got the investigators' attention, to his business associates to fund his own private ventures.
He was using Thomas's inheritance as his own personal venture capital fund?
Exactly. But the smoking gun wasn't just a digital transfer. It was a piece of real estate. During the investigation, they found that one of the properties Thomas inherited had its title moved directly into the name of Dawood's wife.
His wife? That's not even trying to hide it. That's brazen. Did he think no one would check the county recorder's office?
He counted on Thomas's technological gap and his isolation. He figured by the time anyone looked, the trail would be cold. But the FBI tracked the money into two specific purchases, high-end real estate in La Crescenta and Fontana. Both of these cities are located in Southern California. We've driven past them many times in our numerous travels from Northern California to the desert in Southern California. They're both very nice cities right off the freeway.
Okay, I was probably sleeping by then. That drive is so long and so boring sometimes, so I get why I may not remember the names or the freeway exits. But Nick, the money wasn't just gone. It was sitting in a driveway or a backyard in Fontana.
It was converted into hard assets. And that leads us to the most intense part of this entire case, the trial. Because when Dawood was finally caught, he didn't fold. He did something even more dangerous.
What did he do?
He claimed Thomas gave him permission. He produced documents with signatures and tried to convince a jury that a 70-year-old man simply forgot he gave away $2 million. This is where the case moves from the bank vault to the courtroom. We're in July 2025, and Jamal Dawood is facing a 7-day federal trial. Most scammers fold when the FBI shows up with a warrant, but Dawood, he decided to double down on the lie.
I can't imagine the pressure on Thomas. He's in his late 70s. He's lost his brother. He's lost his money. And now he has to sit in a federal court and be questioned by the man who robbed him?
It was worse than that, Sue. Daywood's defense attorney, Mark Worksman, didn't just deny the theft. He tried to flip the script. He argued that Thomas wasn't a victim at all, but a sophisticated, tech-savvy businessman who knew exactly what he was signing. They actually called a handwriting expert to the stand to testify that the signatures on those property transfers were authentic.
They tried to claim he willingly gave away his own home and his brother's inheritance? How do you even fight that if there's an expert saying the signature is real?
You fight it with the truth of the victim. Thomas stood his ground. He sat on that witness stand, looked at those documents, and told the jury plainly, "I did not sign these." But the real turning point was the judge's reaction. U.S. District Judge James V. Selna saw right through the smoke and mirrors. During sentencing, he basically scoffed at the defense's argument. He said, "You'd think of all the people in the world he would know his own signature."
I love that. It's so simple, yet so powerful. It cuts right through all the expert testimony. But Nick, if the signatures weren't his, how did Dawood get them to look so real?
In my experience, when a predator has total access to your home and your files, they have a library of your life. They can trace, they can cut and paste, or they can use digital tools to replicate a wet signature. The jury ultimately decided the documents were either obtained through fraud or were outright forgeries made possible by the position of trust Dawood held.
So the fiduciary mask finally slipped. But even with a guilty verdict, the money is already gone into those properties in La Crescenta and Fontana, right?
That's the paper victory problem. Dawood was convicted of 6 counts of wire fraud and 9 counts of money laundering. But as we move into the final act of part one, we have to talk about the 10-year sentence and why the judge refused to give him a single inch of leniency.
I want to hear that. Because after what he put Thomas through, sorry doesn't quite cover it.
We've looked at the theft, the shell companies, and the circus of a trial. But now we have to talk about the why. Why did the judge hand down a 120-month sentence? In federal court, that's a decade behind bars. For a financial crime, that is a massive hammer.
It is. We see people get far less for what seem like more violent crimes. Was it just the dollar amount, or was there something else in Dawood's file that tipped the scales?
It was his history. In my years of investigating, the most dangerous predator isn't the one who makes a mistake. It's the one who views prison as a cost of doing business. Jamal Dawood wasn't a first-time offender. He had a prior conviction for a similar fraud and had already served 6 years in state prison.
6 years? So he did 6 years, got out, and his first move was to find a grieving elderly man and do it all over again? That's not a mistake. That's a lifestyle.
Exactly right, Sue. The prosecutors argued that he was solely motivated by greed and that the previous 6 years taught him nothing. Judge Selna agreed. He saw that the only way to protect the public from Dawood was to remove him from the public for another decade.
And then there's the money. $1.8 million in restitution. Nick, be honest with me. Given your experience with these types, does Thomas ever actually see that money again?
That is the heartbreaking reality of these cases. By the time we get to a verdict, the cash is usually gone. It's been washed through those properties in La Crescenta and Fontana. To get it back, the government has to go through a grueling process of civil forfeiture and unwinding those fraudulent titles. It's a second legal battle that can take years.
So Thomas is in his late 70s, facing years of more legal paperwork just to get back what was already his. It feels like the crime doesn't end when the handcuffs go on. It just enters a new, more bureaucratic phase.
You're hitting on something vital there, Sue. Most people think the win is the conviction, but for the victim, the win is being made whole. And that is where the investigation takes a turn into the truly technical side of forensic accounting.
Technical in what way? If the judge orders him to pay, doesn't the government just take it?
I wish it were that simple. When a predator like Dawood moves assets into shell companies, he creates a legal maze. He's not just hiding the money. He's trying to legalize the theft by making the properties look like legitimate business holdings.
So the FBI isn't just looking for bank accounts anymore. They're looking at property titles, corporate filings, and those business associates you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. We need to look at how they unwind a shell company. Because while Dawood was sitting in his cell, the government was busy filing civil forfeiture actions against the properties in La Crescenta and Fontana. This is where the battle for restitution actually begins.
Let's dig into that unwinding process. How do you prove a house bought with clean-looking corporate checks was actually built on a foundation of stolen inheritance?
To understand how we catch them at this stage, we have to talk about source of funds analysis. When the FBI looked at those properties in La Crescenta and Fontana, they didn't just look at who owned the house today. They looked at every single dollar used for the down payment, the closing costs, and even the improvements Dawood claimed he made.
Oh, right. The improvements his lawyer tried to use to lower the restitution amount. He actually had the nerve to ask for a discount because he spent stolen money to renovate a stolen house?
Can you believe that? He wanted a credit for $742,944. The judge, thankfully, didn't buy it. But that highlights the predator's mindset. They truly believe that once they've processed the money, it becomes theirs.
So how does the FBI prove the link? If the money passed through three different accounts before hitting the title company, how do you keep the chain intact?
We follow the digital breadcrumbs. To really understand the shell game, you have to look at how Dawood used Thomas's own lack of digital literacy as a weapon. He didn't just hide the money. He layered it through a series of entities that looked, on paper, like legitimate investment vehicles.
When you say layered, are we talking about those companies he set up to take the titles of the houses?
Exactly. He created a network of shell companies, entities with professional-sounding names that existed only on a hard drive and in a filing cabinet. He convinced Thomas that transferring the titles of his home and his brother's real estate into these companies was sophisticated asset protection. In reality, it was a legal severance.
So the moment the ink dried on those transfer documents, Thomas didn't own a home anymore. The company did. And since Dawood controlled the company, he effectively stole a house with a ballpoint pen.
Precisely. But here is where the digital breadcrumbs come in. Even with shell companies, you have to pay the bills. The FBI started looking at the bank accounts for these corporations. They found that the money flowing out of those accounts wasn't going to property taxes or insurance. It was going to a title company for a new purchase.
Let me guess, the properties in La Crescenta and Fontana?
Bingo. Dawood used the liquid cash he drained from Thomas's trust account to buy himself a luxury lifestyle. He was laundering the stolen inheritance in real time, converting digital cash into physical dirt and shingles.
It's so brazen. He's sitting in Thomas's living room, calling him an old fool, while using Thomas's own money to buy a house just a few miles away. How did the FBI bridge that final gap? How do you prove account A paid for house B when there are five shells in between?
That is the art of the forensic accountant. They look for the nexus. They found that the same digital signature used to authorize the theft from Thomas's trust was the one used to sign the purchase agreements in Fontana. Dawood got lazy. He used the same back door for both the robbery and the shopping spree.
There's a certain poetic justice in that. The very technological gap he used to blind Thomas was the thing that left a permanent digital record for the feds.
It was his undoing. But the damage was done. The cash was gone, converted into real estate that was now tied up in his wife's name and his associates' names. And that leads us to the most difficult question of all. In a world of digital theft, is a 10-year sentence enough to pay back the years of life Thomas lost?
That's a question we have to answer, because as we've seen, the prison walls are only half the story. The real battle is the one for restitution.
And that is exactly where we will pick up in part two of this series. We're going to walk through the unwinding. How do you take a house away from a scammer's family and give it back to the victim? It's a legal war that is just as complex as the scam itself.
That's right, Nick. There is a lot of backstory to this federal case, which is why we decided to break this down into a two-part series. But there's still more, right, Nick, before we close this one out?
Yes, there is, Sue. And we've spent a lot of time on the numbers, but I want to talk about the mental game. During my career in federal law enforcement, I learned that sometimes the hardest part of a fraud case isn't tracing the money. It's the victim's own doubt. Jamal Dawood didn't just steal from Thomas. He made Thomas believe he was losing his mind.
That's the part that feels so personal. You mentioned he would call Thomas an old fool. Was that just to be mean, or was there a strategic reason for the abuse?
It's a classic interrogation avoidance tactic. Whenever Thomas would notice a discrepancy, maybe a late bill or a missing statement, Dawood would go on the offensive. He would tell Thomas that he'd already explained it, or that Thomas had forgotten the conversation. He used Thomas's age as a silencer.
It's heartbreaking. If you're told enough times that your memory is failing, you eventually stop trusting your own eyes. Did you see this a lot in federal investigations?
Constantly. Many of the cases I handled never even made it to a grand jury because the victims were too embarrassed to come forward. They felt that if they admitted they'd been scammed, their families would put them in a home or take away their independence. Dawood knew exactly how to play that fear.
So he wasn't just managing the money, he was managing the shame.
Precisely. But let's look at the investigative hurdles. When the FBI first stepped in, they weren't just fighting Dawood. They were fighting the trusted advisor defense. Because Dawood was listed as a fiduciary-like figure, every transfer he made had a veneer of legality.
So if he wired $50,000 to a quote-unquote business associate, on paper it just looks like an investment?
Exactly. To a bank teller or a basic auditor, it looks like a routine transaction. To prove it was a crime, the FBI had to go into the intent. They had to show that those business associates weren't actually doing business, they were just pass-through accounts. We call this the audit of lies.
I like that. So the FBI becomes the world's most intense bookkeepers. How did they find the link to the Fontana property? Did they just follow the checks?
It was the escrow trail. In real estate, you can't hide the source of funds forever. The FBI tracked a specific wire transfer from Thomas's trust directly into an escrow account for a home in Fontana. Dawood had the audacity to use the stolen money as a down payment for a house that was then titled to his wife.
His wife? So the theft was a family affair. Did she ever claim she didn't know where the money came from?
That's a common defense. But in federal court, the ostrich defense, sticking your head in the sand, doesn't usually work when you're living in a mansion bought with someone else's inheritance.
It's a web that just keeps getting stickier. But even with the FBI closing in, Dawood was still making moves, wasn't he?
He was. He was attempting to move the remaining assets into offshore accounts or untraceable cryptos. He was in a race against the clock. And that brings us to the moment the back door finally slammed shut. We have to address the elephant in the room. How does $1.8 million leave a trust account, managed by a financial expert, without a single alarm bell ringing at the bank? In my 25 years of investigating all types of financial fraud, the institutional blind spot is usually where the most damage is done.
It's a great question. If I try to buy a pair of shoes in a different zip code, my bank sends me a text, an email, and freezes my card. But Jamal Dawood can wire six figures to a shell company in Fontana and nobody notices? It feels like the system is set up to catch the small fish and let the sharks swim right through the net.
You're exactly right, and the reason is behavioral normalization. Because Dawood had established himself as the authorized advisor, his high-dollar movements looked like business as usual to the bank's automated systems. He was essentially wearing a digital invisibility cloak.
But Thomas was still going into the branch. He was talking to tellers. If the bank saw Thomas, who they knew as a conservative in-person customer, coming in to check a balance while his advisor was simultaneously draining that same account online, shouldn't that discrepancy have triggered a manual review?
That is the million-dollar question, Sue. Or in this case, the $2 million question. In the Jamal Nathan Daywood case, we saw a total failure of what I call multi-channel security. The bank treated the in-person activity and the digital activity as two separate people. They didn't connect the dots that the person at the window wasn't the one clicking send on the wire transfers.
It makes me realize how much we rely on these institutions to protect us. If they aren't looking at the person and only looking at the password, we're all at risk. How did the FBI finally force the bank to look at the patterns?
They didn't wait for the bank. The FBI used forensic accounting to create a heat map of the money. They showed that the funds weren't just being moved, they were being converted. When a management fee turns into a down payment for a house titled to the advisor's wife, that's not a business transaction. That's a smoking gun.
I want to talk about that heat map, because for our listeners, understanding how to spot those first few drops of a leak is the only way to prevent a flood.
Let's get into the early warning signs. This isn't just about Thomas, it's about anyone managing an inheritance. If your advisor asks for total digital control because you don't understand the tech, that isn't a courtesy, that is a takeover. Now let's talk about those companies Dawood used. He didn't just call them Dawood Stolen Money Inc. He gave them names that sounded like legitimate real estate ventures. This is a tactic I call corporate camouflage.
We see this in our own real estate work. People use LLCs all the time for privacy and liability. How does a regular person tell the difference between a legitimate LLC and a predator's shell company?
You look at the operating agreement. Dawood told Thomas he would be a majority owner in these companies. But when the FBI looked at the actual filings, Thomas's name wasn't anywhere on the documents. Thomas had been convinced to sign title transfer forms, effectively handing his property to an entity he had zero legal stake in.
So he was essentially a tenant in his own home the moment he signed.
Worse, he was a guest who could be evicted at any time by the owner, which was Dawood. This is why the Department of Justice pushed for such a high sentence. This wasn't just a theft of money, it was a theft of sovereignty.
And that leads us to the final piece of the puzzle for part one. We've seen the betrayal, the digital wall, and the corporate camouflage. Now, we have to look at the man who thought he could get away with it.
We've talked about the how, but we have to talk about the who. Why did Jamal Dawood think he could get away with this in broad daylight? In my experience, it comes down to one word, hubris. You see, Dawood wasn't just a scammer, he was a repeat offender. He had already served 6 years in state prison for a similar fraud.
6 years! You'd think that would be enough of a wake-up call. Did he think that federal investigators wouldn't notice a pattern?
On the contrary, Sue, I think he believed his previous stint made him smarter. He thought he had learned how to bridge the evidence gap. He believed that by using shell companies and complex property transfers, he could hide behind a corporate veil that the FBI wouldn't bother to pierce.
It sounds like he viewed prison as just a training seminar for his next big heist. That's a terrifying level of commitment to a criminal lifestyle.
It is, and the prosecutors made sure the judge knew it. During the trial, Assistant U.S. Attorney Kristen Spencer pointed out that Dawood did not learn from his past. He remained solely motivated by greed. When you have someone who views other people's life savings as their own personal piggy bank, leniency is off the table.
And that's why the 10-year sentence was so significant. It wasn't just about the $1.8 million. It was about stopping a predator who had proven he wouldn't stop on his own.
Exactly. But as we look at the final minutes of this first part, I want to pivot back to the victim, Thomas Battaglia. Thomas didn't just lose money, he lost his sense of self. One of the most heartbreaking parts of the Department of Justice report is how Dawood isolated him. A family member testified that Dawood would verbally disparage Thomas, calling him an old fool whenever he asked questions.
That kind of emotional abuse is a silencer. It makes the victim hide the crime out of shame. Nick, in your 25 years as a special agent, how often did you see this shame factor keep people from calling for help?
Almost every single time. Scammers like Dawood are experts at psychological warfare. They make the victim feel like they are the ones making mistakes. Thomas was lucky. He had family who started noticing the red flags. But for many, the silence is where the scam thrives.
This is why reporting through the National Elder Fraud Hotline is so critical. It's a way to break that silence with people who actually understand the mechanics of the theft.
And that leads us to the bridge. We've seen how the trap was built. We've seen the architecture of the predator. But how do we tear it down?
That's the big question. Because the money is still sitting in those houses in La Crescenta and Fontana, and Thomas is still waiting.
In part two, we are going to dive into the war of restitution. We're going to look at the FBI's role in tracing the transfers across state lines and the specific civil forfeiture steps required to unwind a shell company. If you think the scam was complex, wait until you see the legal battle to get the money back.
I'm ready. Let's get into the forensic recovery.
Before we move to the recovery, I want to leave our listeners with three tactical red flags from the Dawood case. These are the things that, if spotted early, could have saved Thomas $1.8 million.
Let's hear them, because if we can save even one person from this, everything we're doing here is worth it.
Red flag number one, the technological takeover. If an advisor insists on setting up your digital banking and tells you that you don't need the password because they'll handle it, that is a siren going off. You must always maintain your own digital keys.
Red flag number two?
The corporate severance. If anyone asks you to transfer the title of your primary residence or an inheritance into an LLC or a protection entity that they control, do not sign. Consult an independent attorney.
And the third?
The behavioral shift. If you find yourself frequently visiting a bank branch in person while an advisor is aggressively moving your funds online, that discrepancy is your best chance to alert the bank's security team. Don't let them treat your physical and digital lives as separate entities.
Those are powerful, and they lead us perfectly into the next phase of our investigation.
As we reach the final stage of our look into the architecture, I want to step back from Jamal Dawood for a moment and look at the bigger picture. In my career, I didn't just chase individual ghosts like Dawood. I tracked the data, and the data tells a terrifying story. We are currently in the middle of a $3.4 billion elder fraud epidemic in this country.
$3.4 billion? That's not a crime wave, Nick. That's a global industry. How much of that is coming from trusted advisors versus the random offshore calls we all get?
That's the distinction people need to understand. While the offshore tech support scams get the headlines, the most devastating losses, the ones that truly wipe out a family's generational wealth, come from assistance-based fraud. It's the person you know, the person you let into your home. It's the insider threat.
It makes me think about Thomas sitting in that Burbank branch. The bank has all these high-tech algorithms to catch a hacker in Eastern Europe, but they couldn't see the man standing right in front of them. Is there a movement in the industry to fix this institutional blind spot?
There is, but it's slow. We're starting to see a push for behavioral biometrics and better multi-channel monitoring. Essentially, the bank needs to realize that if Thomas is at the teller window in person, no one, not even his authorized advisor, should be allowed to initiate a wire transfer online at the exact same moment.
It seems like common sense. If the physical body is at the bank, the digital ghost shouldn't be allowed to move the money. It's about syncing the two worlds.
Exactly. But until the banks catch up, the burden of defense falls on us. It falls on the families and the investigators. When I look back at the Jamal Nathan Dawood case, I see a missed opportunity for early intervention. If the bank had just asked Thomas one simple question during his branch visit, "Are you aware of the six-figure wire transfer being processed right now?" this whole story would have ended differently.
And that's the reality we have to face. The system is reactive, not proactive. By the time the FBI's financial crimes unit gets involved, the damage is done. The money is in Fontana, the house is in La Crescenta, and the victim is in debt.
Which is why part two of this series is so critical. We've spent 40 minutes dissecting the betrayal. Now we're going to spend part two of this series on the war.
The war for restitution.
Yes, we're going to talk about the National Elder Fraud Hotline, the legal process of unwinding title transfers, and the specific forensic tools used to prove that a house bought with clean money was actually built on a foundation of theft. I also want to discuss what is known as suspicious activity reports filed by banks when they detect suspicious banking activity. During my career, I reviewed numerous suspicious activity reports filed by banks all over the United States. And unfortunately, a large majority of these reports dealt with suspicious financial activities related to elderly customers and clients of the banks. These reports relayed clearly destructive financial patterns against a large portion of our senior population. But what was being done about this activity is another story, which I will talk about in our next episode.
Nick, that sounds fascinating and something important for all our listeners to hear. I'm definitely ready to hear about your experiences, as well as for the recovery phase of this story. Because justice isn't just a 10-year sentence, it's getting the victim's life back.
Absolutely right, Sue. And to our listeners, please join us for part two right here on Behind the Scams, where we move from the crime scene to the recovery room. You won't want to miss this episode.
That's right, Nick. We all have a lot we can learn from real-life cases like this. That's why we do what we do here on Behind the Scams and throughout the SOS Media Network. Until then, this is Sue saying bye for now.